Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order, the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. And we'll start out with the roll, Mr. Sparby.
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard?
Here.
Representative Mullery? Representative Doubt?
Here.
Representative Gauthier? Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hilty?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kelly? Representative Kiefer?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Eidegger?
Here.
Representative Mariani? Representative McDonald? Representative Moran?
Here.
Representative Nornes? Representative Slocum? Representative Smith?
Here.
Okay, a quorum being present, entertain a motion for accepting the minutes of March 13th.
I'll move.
Representative Smith moves the minutes of March 13th. Any additions, corrections, or questions? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Members, I wanted to start out probably with just giving a short introduction of what's going to happen today and what we'd kind of like to happen. They're just my wishes. It's not necessarily those of the committee. We'll wait to see what those are to the end. But we have two bills up today, both of them fairly controversial. And a lot of attention has been gathered on them in the Criminal Data Intelligence and MnJAC Fusion Center bills to follow after mine. And I would kind of like to not take amendments today and forward them to the Data Civil Law Committee eventually, if there's if the committee is willing, because so much of the content is under the purview of the Civil Law Committee and Data Privacy Section, but we also want to give them a full hearing. I expect to be here maybe till noon and give each one a full hearing, ask all the questions you would like, probably a lesser amount in the data privacy, but to feel free, we don't restrict anybody from asking these questions, and we'll let anybody testify that wishes to. So basically, my bill is going to be on criminal intelligence data, and I'll give kind of the introduction from up here, and what this is there was a revolves out of a number of things. It's been kind of a revolving wheel. It's never a problem. It's never got solved over the last few years. And law enforcement actually wants this bill, even though it'll somewhat restrict them in what they can and can't do and open other avenues where they can and can't get information and how they store it and classify it. And then there's naturally some concern from the private sector groups and business groups also on the bill that we'll ask a number of questions about. But was some of the things came out of the 27-25 work group and never came to a full agreement at all on how this criminal intelligence data should be handled. So rather than let it just go on from year to year with wondering what we can and can't do, we'd really like to get it defined in statute. And so that's the reason for the hearing today. So I'll be presenting House File 2470, and I'll have my vice chair take over for me and probably try to divide the hearing time up equally split. And what I'd like to do is have the law enforcement groups that are going to testify on my bill all finish their testimony and then come back for questions, because I think I've told them what the main concerns are, and I think they'll knock off a lot of the questions we're going to answer, save a lot of time if we let them get all done and then come back and ask any questions if you would wish, if that's okay. Sound like a plan, DFL side? All right. And then I got here this morning to find this large bill here. It's when you turn 60 years old, they give you these things like this to read. At least they didn't give me a box of Depends with it.
Mr. Chair, welcome to the committee.
We have my testifiers come forward. I'm going to start right in, and this going to...
Civil law. So we can go ahead and move the bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 2470 be recommended to pass and move to the Civil Law Committee.
Representative Cornish.
And since I've already given my introduction, if unless you've got something, and have Sheriff Stanek start off with the testimony on the bill.
Sheriff Stanek, please state your name for the record.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair members. My name is Rich Stanek, Sheriff in Hennepin County. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, who supports House File 2470. I think Representative Cornish kind of laid out generally what he has in mind. In terms of our testifiers this morning, myself talking about from a law enforcement perspective, Deputy Chief Rick Hart here from Bloomington PD talking from a private sector law enforcement perspective, and then Chief Mike Goldstein from Plymouth and Lieutenant Spencer Bakke from Hennepin County. We're both working members of the work group 2725, and they want to talk a little more specifically about the bill itself, and then all of us members will be available for our questions following our testimony. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, can we continue?
Please go ahead, Chair.
Great. Well, like I said, I'm here to speak in support of House File 2470 and talk about the importance of this legislation keenly from a local law enforcement standpoint. Representative Cornish is right. This issue itself has been batted around the legislature the last several years. It is not an easy issue to grasp and deal with, but one that local law enforcement chiefs and sheriff's associations feel very strongly about. But let me start out, Mr. Chair members, with the definition of criminal intelligence as defined by the International Chiefs of Police National Law Enforcement Policy Center. And this would be a working definition that we use. A criminal intelligence member is defined as information compiled, analyzed, and or disseminated in the effort to anticipate, prevent, or monitor criminal activity. Real simple, a definition of that is information plus analysis equals intelligence. So information plus analysis equals intelligence data. The people in Minnesota, Mr. Chair and members, expect law enforcement agencies to be proactive in our policing strategies. And they expect us to know what's going on and to predict and prevent crime. Now, this is modern law enforcement here today across the metro area, across the state of Minnesota, and really across this country. We believe that citizens generally believe that if police have information about something, then we're going to do something about it, act on it. And that's exactly what we're doing with Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, our criminal information sharing and analysis unit, as one example. We review, evaluate, analyze information, and then we share the information put out to officers on the street, out in the field, connecting dots to predict and prevent future crime from occurring. But with these changes in law enforcement practices, it's time to revisit our state's data practices laws. Minnesota's data practices law, Mr. Chair and members, as you know, have not been updated over the last 40 years in regards to this piece of it. We need our data practice laws to be updated to address threats that face our communities today. And this is why the Sheriffs and Chiefs Associations have put criminal intelligence classification at the top of their priority list this legislative session, and why we bring it to you today and the other committees to follow. Mr. Chair members, by classifying criminal intelligence data as confidential data on individuals for a period of 1 year and private data after 1 year, unless additional criteria are met, well, this is going to ensure a level playing field across law enforcement agencies. But currently, due to a lack of protection for criminal intelligence data in Minnesota, people and private entities are reporting crimes directly to the FBI without local law enforcement agency knowing what's going on in their jurisdiction. And I believe you're going to hear a little more about that from Deputy Chief Hart here in a minute. Mr. Chair members, Minnesota is an island amongst other states as it relates to having criminal intelligence classification. Our statutes on data collection and retention do not match other states. Law enforcement agencies across the state are receiving and collecting this information every day, but we have no language and statute for criminal intelligence, often leaving practitioners to try and fit the data into the incident or the investigative data classifications. And this data, or this legislation, will put in to law the best practices and the standards already used at the federal level. It provides consistent standards for purging and retention and collection of criminal intelligence data. And for these reasons, I'm going to ask you on behalf of the residents of Hennepin County as well as the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to support criminal intelligence data classification in Minnesota. And Mr. Chair, members, with your permission, Deputy Chief Rick Hart.
Thank you, Sheriff. And Deputy Chief, please state your name for the record.
Rick Hart, H-A-R-T.
Okay, go ahead.
Chair members, I'm here to tell you a story about a relationship with the Mall of America. Obviously, we consider it a critical infrastructure, number one retail and entertainment complex in the state of Minnesota. And on the radar, we think, of terrorist groups and activities that would affect the Mall of America. And certainly anything that would happen there would have terrific impact, not only on commerce, but also worldwide media attention. And certainly it would be very bad for everyone. We had a really good working relationship with American Security. They have a lot of very good employees that are trying to do the right thing, and they would accumulate information on people. They would stop and detain people and talk to them. A lot of those were just consensual type things, and people would give them what they needed, and they'd be on their way. They would do information reports regarding that, and we would get the information reports. We would be called to the specific scene if they felt that there was a need for us to respond, and then we would take it over. About 125 of these incidents reports, these reports that Mall of America Security provided, were subject to a media release in 2010 to 2011. Those reports discussed a lot of things such as procedures, security measures, lockdown drills, and issues that the mall obviously wasn't real excited about releasing, nor were we, but we were forced to under Chapter 13. And that has strained the relationship with Mall of America Security and the Bloomington Police Department. They were forced to report things directly to the federal law enforcement agencies, and they took the local law enforcement agencies out of the mix. Therefore, we were blind as to what was going on in our own city. Unfortunately, that created a lot of stress and strain on both of the organizations, Mall of America and Bloomington Police Department. And again, we have this valuable critical infrastructure in our city, and we're really not sure what's going on there. It took all of the tools out of the toolbox, so to speak, with us. And I'm here today in support of the Bill 2470. I think it would be a solution to this problem that we have in private sector security agencies reporting directly to the federal government instead of local law enforcement.
Thank you, Deputy Chief. And I believe we also have Chief Goldstein as well. And Chief, if you can just state your name for the record for us.
Mike Goldstein, G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N.
Go ahead, Chief.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair and committee members. It's an honor to be before you today. I'm representing both the City of Plymouth on this bill in that our City Council has made this one of their legislative priorities, and I'm also representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association as I am a board member on their board. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak on House File 2470, which would be an amendment to Chapter 13 that would allow for the collection of criminal intelligence data by law enforcement personnel. I have been working on this issue for the last 5 years in a variety of capacities to help move this issue along, as I believe that Minnesota's law enforcement efforts are hampered by not having the capabilities that these proposed provisions would provide. Over the course of time, I have worked with many privacy advocates and clearly understand their concerns. It is my belief that this law would actually alleviate the privacy advocates' concerns and that this legislation would create a sound structure for all Minnesota law enforcement to follow that is based on best practices, which would include retention limits, purging and auditing requirements, along with sanctions, as already noted in Chapter 13, for those who intentionally violate this provision. Specifically speaking, the state of Minnesota is one of a very few states within the United States without a classification for intelligence data. Currently, there are three classifications where law enforcement can place government data: public, non-public, private, and confidential. Most everything that we collect is public data under law. Our department alone is involved with approximately 70,000 events every year, and a great majority of those events are documented with some type of a report, which again are usually public in nature. However, when we are investigating a confirmed crime, most data surrounding that event is classified as confidential, whereby only law enforcement personnel have access to the information. That said, law enforcement officers are called to myriad events every day, and there are situations when something we are called to piques our interest, yet time is needed to sort out what is happening. The details many times do not lead to an obvious crime under the current law, and law enforcement personnel are left to classify this as public data, which could lead to significant problems, or they can manufacture what was a criminal case to protect the data. Neither of these two circumstances is appropriate. While this factor alone causes me concern, there are five other important points that I'd like to make regarding what this amendment would also impact. Some of those issues you've heard from the previous individuals who testified. There's a traveling data provision that would be allowed under this bill. Because of the criminal mobility and the worldwide use of the internet to facilitate criminal activity, information regarding crime trends and active investigations must be shared in an open and trusted manner between law enforcement jurisdictions. Currently, Minnesota Chapter 13 makes active criminal investigative data shared by law enforcement agencies outside of Minnesota with Minnesota agencies public data if we do not have an active criminal investigation here in Minnesota. Therefore, states, you know, like Iowa or Wisconsin, who have this provision in law, will not share their information with local law enforcement in the state of Minnesota in fear of their information becoming public. Private sector sharing. Crime prevention and criminal apprehension is a community responsibility. Local law enforcement personnel rely on cooperation with residents and the business community to report criminal activity as well as provide important witness information and evidence to assist in the investigative process. Information reported in confidence to law enforcement agencies from private sector businesses currently becomes public the minute the investigative case becomes inactive. Because of this, businesses run the risk of exposing details of corporate operations, security procedures, and exposure to lawsuits, as you already heard from Deputy Chief Hart. The potential chilling effect to open cooperation between local law enforcement and private sector entities is huge. 85% of the critical infrastructure within the state of Minnesota is owned by private businesses, and we do not want them to hesitate reporting information to local law enforcement. Personal privacy. On a daily basis, law enforcement agencies receive information from a variety of sources alleging criminal activity and or suspicious behavior. Agency representatives are bound by policy and procedure to document these allegations, even if the source might be questionable. Once documented, those reports are subject to Chapter 13 and records retention rules. Many times, an initial investigation is inconclusive and quickly becomes an inactive case, changing the classification to public data. Subject to disclosure, anyone who requests it will get it. Negative impacts to the privacy, reputation, and potential safety of subjects of these unfounded allegations can be the result. Uniformity and structure. Lack of definition in current law identifying what constitutes an active criminal investigation and the ability to provide reasonable protections for criminal intelligence data have contributed to broad interpretations of the data status, as I indicated before. Agencies may rely too much on the confidential classification, overly restrict access to data or retain data well past its investigative value. The results of this is an overall mistrust with law enforcement, painting all agencies, regardless of their diligence, in a negative light. Comprehensive legislation which defines a graduated structure of law enforcement data from initial and criminal intelligence data to active investigative data with accompanying retention rules provide structure, accountability, transparency, and uniformity. And lastly, expectations, and this is what I find probably one of the most important points. Collecting, analyzing, and using data to prevent criminal conduct from occurring is a time-tested, proactive policing measure. Progressive law enforcement organizations throughout the country use intelligence data to better protect their communities. Minnesotans have the same prudent expectations from their law enforcement entities, yet without this bill, there are a multitude of barriers from collecting this data to help keep Minnesotans safe. For example, and then I will conclude, about 5 years ago, one of our officers made a traffic stop, and it was an uneventful stop. There was no citation issued. It was a verbal warning. Sometime after the stop, we were contacted by a federal agency making an inquiry as to what our contact was with this individual. We explained that we stopped them for a minor moving violation, offered a verbal warning, and that was the end of our contact. That agency had information on that individual that they were tracking and that they had not until this point shared with us. This person was a resident within our community. A short-term resident, but someone nonetheless who lived there and interacted with other community members. When we inquired further as to why this federal agency was interested in this individual, they told us they couldn't tell us because if they did, the information would become public under Minnesota law. And that's problematic for us. It's a threat to our officers who might be responding back to this person's residence, or if they ever encountered them again in a traffic situation. and it's a threat to the community because we have no idea why this individual was a person of interest. The person lived within our community for about 9 or 10 months and then moved away. Lost track of them, have no idea what the potential issue ever was. But again, the barrier within Chapter 13 prevented us from having that information. I want to thank you for your thoughtful consideration on this matter, and I think we'll come back and answer questions if anyone should have any.
Thank you, Chief. Is there anybody else in the audience who'd like to testify in favor of the bill? Okay, seeing no one stand up, are there any questions from members at this point before we go to the opposition? Representative Johnson.
Just briefly for clarification, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, what is the working group 2725, and who's involved in putting the bill together?
Representative Cornish?
I think I'll have Chief both need to answer that since he's part of the group, if you could.
Okay, go ahead, Chief.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, thank you. SF 2725 was a working group that began in, was it late 2010, I believe? And the intent was the Senate created this working group to evaluate this particular issue along with different databases that either once existed or currently exist, and to look at the whole notion of Chapter 13 and any sort of amendments that ought to be made to it. It was comprised of members that were specifically designated from the various associations, chiefs of police, Minnesota Peace Officers Association, Minnesota Sheriffs Association. There was media representatives, social service advocates who were a part of it, privacy advocates, the criminal defense bar was there along with prosecutors as well. So it was a mix of professionals and interested parties coming together to discuss this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe at some point you could get that information to us just so we had it for our record. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Chair Cornish, I see this is a very big bill, at least the one I have. And I mean that literally and figuratively. Seems like there could be a lot of unintended consequences in this bill, and I'm very hesitant to support this. And I trust that that's why we're here, to vet this out. I'm just curious, much of what the police do now is public, and how will this change according to this bill?
Chief, go ahead. And just a reminder to members that humor is the purview of the chair.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I said humor is the purview of the chair. Thank you. Go ahead, Chief.
Mr. Vice Chair, committee members. You know, I'll try to paint a picture, and hopefully this will help answer the question. As I talked about, there are three current classifications for data. We've got public, non-public, and confidential. And really the only thing that rests within confidential is active investigative data. So a crime has occurred, we're investigating it, and therefore even the subject of the data might not have access to it under that classification. Just law enforcement does as they work through the investigation. But many things that we are called to aren't necessarily defined immediately as a crime or that we can define as a crime. We've got something nebulous and we don't know what to do with it. And so what happens is it's either public, and if someone should inquire about it, we're obligated to release it, or we stretch the confidential bucket wider than it should be stretched and classify it as a crime or a potential crime that's taking place. And therefore we can protect the data as we work through the process. This fourth bucket, the criminal intelligence bucket, would give us a temporary resting place to hold information while we work through that nebulous piece to determine, is there something here to really follow up on or is there not? And if there isn't, it would be purged within the retention guidelines set forth in the bill. Does that answer your question?
Representative McDonald?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Reasonably so, but not really.
Okay.
But it leads me to another question regarding Section 1, Subdivision 117, 1.17.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I bring this up is because I was approached by someone a lot smarter than I in dealing with the law, and the letter of the law, was concerned that if this passes, that one who collects perhaps by legally, guns and ammo and stocks up and ready for Armageddon, food, et cetera, bunkers and stuff. Under this bill, under Section 117, criminal predicate means sufficient articulable facts along with rational inferences from those facts. And it gives employees working under the supervision of the law enforcement agencies a basis to believe that there is reasonable possibility that a person is involved in a crime or a terrorist activity. So one who collects guns or ammo or stocks up for Armageddon, this would give the extension of the law and a reasonable, plausible, sufficient facts to investigate this person under terrorist or criminal activity. And if you could prove me otherwise, I'd appreciate that.
Chief, you want to take that one?
Mr. Chair and committee members, well, I don't know that I can prove or disprove anything. I can only speak to the intent, at least, of how we run our organization. If someone is a gun collector or collects ammunition or something in that realm that you're speaking of, it's not relevant to us. It's not important to us. Right now, we could track them anyways. This doesn't give us anything more, or it doesn't take necessarily anything away that we currently have. If somebody is interested in it for whatever purposes, about somebody collecting firearms, I guess that's their prerogative. And again, in today under Chapter 13, they could be looked at, and with this, they could be looked at as well. I think the criminal predicate piece is tied to a definition that is legally sound and defined definition in both, you know, statute and in case law that relates to reasonable suspicion. And if we have facts and circumstances which would cause a reasonable person to suspect that criminal activity is afoot, so if we believe that this gun collector was involved in criminal activity, collecting illegal guns, maybe not having permits to collect the guns that they have or the proper licensing to do so, then that's something we may pay attention to, whether with this or without this law, because we can already do that with what currently exists.
Sure. Okay. Yes, go ahead, Representative Corish.
Just for some clarification, as we progress through this, and the questions, and they're good questions and they should be asked, but you can see by just the nature of the bill, it's Chapter 13. That's why I'm kind of anxious to not to get done, and we go through all the questions you want, but it really should be in the Civil Law Committee, because if it was a Department of Corrections or something under our purview, then we just dissect it bit by bit. But all these same questions and cautions are going to be gone over in the Civil Law Committee, and that's right under their, that's what they do, 90% of their work is the Chapter 13. So, but we can feel free to ask all these questions, but some of them are going to be tough, because when we get to civil law, they're really the experts on civil law, and that they're going to ask all these again and amend. And
thank you, Representative Cornish. I think that's a good reminder for us to look at that. Representative Leidiger?
Mr. Chairman, can I just follow up?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on one last question. I understand that the bill also will get rid of any probable cause. It'll no longer be needed for any search warrants, the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And I think that should give us grave concern.
Chief, did you want to take that one?
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, that is, I'm not trying to contradict you, but that's not my understanding of the bill. We're not interested in getting rid of probable cause. Probable cause is an important benchmark that absolutely needs to be met. When you have a probable cause, you're no longer in the criminal intelligence realm. You're now in that investigative bucket. You're in that confidential classification that currently exists. Therefore, we would have to present, you know, articulable facts to a higher authority to get that search warrant. This doesn't preclude that. It's not trying to usurp that. This is just a simple mechanism to collect information and have a temporary holding stop place for it until we can determine whether or not it's relevant or irrelevant. If it's irrelevant, we'll get rid of it. And most importantly, it will allow us to have information that our federal partners have access to that we don't. And that's concerning in that, you know, nothing against the FBI, but if there's someone of interest in our community, they shouldn't be the only ones that know about it. We should, too, in that we're going to be the first responders. The FBI isn't going to pick up the 911 call and respond to that location, and we're not going to have the right information that could help keep us and others safe.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Sheriff Goldstein, I'm certainly not picking on you. I didn't make up that question, actually. I have folks, Republican staff, who are come up with, and they dissect the bill and help us educate us on the bill. So it's not something I just pulled out of the thin air. It's a stating a fact that I have with a piece of paper, this research in front of me, that probable cause will be diminished and no longer a warrant will no longer be needed under this law. So unless someone can tell me that this was just printed, maybe there's a mistake, or maybe I need some reading glasses, I have a great concern on that.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chief Goldstein, I'm going to try to approach it a better understanding of the bill from going back to your scenario, if that's okay, and try to understand what the difference would be if this bill was in place. Because you stated that in your scenario, the federal government had approached you because you had stopped the individual. Somehow they found out that that this individual was stopped by a local authority. Do they? So I guess one of the questions are: the federal government is able to see that data on all your stops?
Before you answer that, Chief, I just want to take a little point here. We do have the 9th through 12th graders from Edison High School in Minneapolis, and welcome to the Public Safety Committee. You're watching a real debate about democracy and civil rights and law and order, so you're going to enjoy, I think, the next 30 minutes. So, Chief, go ahead.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, I don't know how they got that information. I don't know.
Okay.
Representative
Mr. Chair. but they approached you then. They wanted to know your whole situation, what happened, but they were not able to share their data with you. Now, what would change if this bill was in place?
Mr. Chief, Vice Chair and committee members, thank you. They would be able to share the data in that. This is my assumption. They had information that they were vetting. If it rose to the level of an active criminal investigation, and it had anything to do with our community where a crime was occurring, they would share that with us. We would open up a criminal case, and we would share the information back and forth. Okay, but they were reacting to something, and it was nebulous. But they were following this person, monitoring his or her activities, and I don't know for what purpose. But because of the current status of Chapter 13, if they gave us that information and we held it and anybody made an inquiry, including the subject of the data, we would have to release it because we did not have an active criminal investigation. So if the FBI would have said, hey, Chief Goldstein, Mr. John Q. Citizen here is on the watch list and we're worried about their ties to somebody in a foreign country. Well, that's not a crime. I wouldn't have an active criminal investigation opened on it. I would have that data. If John Q. Citizen came in and said, hey, I'm curious, do you have anything on me in your database? We would say, yeah, as a matter of fact, we have this information that came in from the FBI that they were monitoring you and they're worried about some associations you might have with someone from a foreign country. They would be entitled to the information. If they went to the FBI and asked the same question, they would be told nothing because the FBI under federal code has the capability to hold information for a temporary period of time while they vet it. Minnesota law enforcement doesn't have that same opportunity.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you. There's a piece of this that I don't know if I have the capability to really drill down to, but it is the idea of transparency and openness, which we currently have right now within our system, and I'm going to say that there may be something going on here that will change that, and I'm afraid that we go down this path and we may have unintended consequences because it was used as a deterrent. The idea of, you know, not providing the information to you because it would have been, because then it would be open information. That's a good thing, I think, to have that open, to have that transparency within our system. It's a wall. It helps to not have too much secrecy within law enforcement or those that are in authority. But I would like to ask one specific question on the government agency. Now, this could have been this was the FBI that asked you about this person, or was it many other? I mean, there's a lot of different agencies. It could have been the Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement. It could have been all sorts of them. Don't they all? In this case, was it the FBI?
It was.
Go ahead, Chief.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, it was a federal agency, and all of the federal agencies fall under the same federal code regarding intelligence data. And to your earlier point, I would argue the antithesis of what you said. I believe that currently we manufacture cases and qualify them as confidential when they're really not. And I believe that this fourth bucket that I keep referring to will actually allow for greater transparency and standardization. Right now, there's no standardization across the state. So each different law enforcement agency can handle the information, you know, within the law, preferably, and as they see fit. But here, it would be clearly delineated and, I think, more transparent. I agree. We don't want to keep secrets. We're not interested in that. We're interested in monitoring organized violent crime, and this will help us do that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish, go ahead.
Before we move on, Representative McDonald asked a good question, but I wanted to bring a testifier up here to clarify it, but there's nothing in this bill that I know of that releases you from the responsibility of going over the threshold on reasonable suspicion or probable cause, but I'd like to get David Brown up here from the County Attorneys Association to see if he would agree with that and talk about reasonable suspicion and probable cause as it relates in this data privacy section here, if I could.
Okay. Mr. Brown, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Vice Chair, members, I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. To go to Representative McDonald's point, or the question that was asked, and it's a good one, nothing in this bill changes the requirement that there be probable cause for a search warrant, that there be probable cause to arrest a suspect. None of that is in any way impacted by this bill. As I read this bill, it only refers to the standard by which law enforcement has to use before they can keep this kind of information. And the important point was, as I understood it, the reason that's in there is because right now there wouldn't necessarily need to be a tie to criminal activity for law enforcement to keep that information. And the point was to have there be what's called a criminal predicate, and it's that reasonable possibility of criminal conduct. So it's only as to what information could be kept under this statute. It has no impact on the constitutional requirements for probable cause, either to arrest or to issue a search warrant.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Representative Gaultier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could have the Chief back.
Chief, you've been elected, Chief Law Enforcement Officer on this one. So,
Chief, you made a couple of comments that I'd like to talk about. You talked about public information, and if people called, you'd have to release that information. How often does that happen, that somebody that you have suspicions about is calling saying, do you have any information on me? And the department has to tell them.
Chief, go ahead.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, not very often.
Okay. Once a week, once a month. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chief? Chair and committee members, I can't speak for all of Minnesota law enforcement. Clearly, there are those who are worried about who's paying attention to them, and they may make more requests than the average individual. In our organization, we get data requests all the time from various law firms and from the media and from interested parties that were a part of a case or might have witnessed a case. People that we have a suspicion about, how often do they come forward? You know, it's hard for me to qualify that, but it's not often.
Yeah.
Representative Goldberg.
Mr. Chair, you also talked about, and I'm glad you're concerned about this, manufacturing a case to keep information confidential.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you think that happens?
Chief? Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, I don't know, and I hate to even delve into that issue, but I want to be as transparent as I can.
Okay.
I think that it occurs. And so it's not appropriate, but without another tool available, that's where the mistrust comes. And I would like to try to prevent that from happening.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Chair, Attorney Brown said something about criminal predicate, and maybe you can answer this, Chief, being reasonable. Who determines what is reasonable under this bill? Is it law enforcement? Is it the county attorney? Is it the attorney general? Who decides that?
Chief, do you want to take that one, or do you want us to call Mr. Brown back? Mr. Brown?
Wake up, Dave.
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, I'll defer if I sink on this, but I think that it's a combination. It's law enforcement with the prosecution making determinations of what is reasonable. And that's the best way that I can answer it.
President Gauthier, would you like to ask that of Mr. Brown? Or
no, that's fine. I'd just like to wrap up here for Mr. Chair.
Sure.
We're going to have a historical day because Representative Leidecker and I are going to agree. Democracy is really messy, and so is freedom and liberty. And it concerns me that as a law enforcement officer, you're telling me that it does happen that we manufacture things. And I think that's real. But I would like to err on the side of public information to preserve people's rights and freedom in this country versus putting this in this mysterious pot called criminal intelligence and giving law enforcement what I consider just unbridled power during that period of time. You know, we've gone way too far since 9/11 in suppressing people's liberties under the name of national security. And I understand that you want to keep your officers safe, and I want to keep them safe, too, and I'm a big advocate of law enforcement, but this is a bad bill. This just stomps on individual freedom, and I would rather err and say, you know, if somebody's calling and asking information, I think that's kind of a good thing about it, because they're suspecting that you guys are on to them, and I think that's a good thing because then they're going to screw up and you're going to arrest them. Is the way I look at it, and I just I you know, and I know the chair doesn't want to really go down this road today, but I think it's important that we vet out all these kind of issues, because you know what there was a statement earlier that talked about we're an island of other states, and quite frankly I get disturbed by every time we're making a law that other states do it. Part of the way Minnesota's a leader is because we don't just follow everybody. We vet things out, we question them, and sure, it might make your job a little harder, but if that prevents you or private security firms at the Mall of America from trampling on people's rights, so be it. And, I think Representative McDonald's idea or example of a survivalist or paramilitary organization, you probably already got covered under the law anyway, so I'm not real worried about that. I'm worried about that he thinks about Armageddon, but
Mr. Chair.
But anyway, I just want to close on that in saying that I think we just need to err on the side of liberty.
Representative Cornish, go ahead.
I think there might be a misunderstanding here that Chief Goldstein here actually was on the side of protecting citizens during this 27-25 work group. He was on the side of finding a solution for the classification of data. the bill here doesn't allow them to delve into anybody's personal lives or this or that any more than or destroy the terms of probable cause, reasonable suspicion. This bill talks about the collection and storing of and classification of criminal intelligence. The problem is now we're floundering because we don't have a uniform definition of criminal intelligence. And you're putting chiefs and sheriffs and law enforcement on the spot without having this definition, because now when they got this pertinent information they don't want to release, there's no classification to protect it. And some of it shouldn't be released. And so they're having to classify it as investigative data or some classification that allows them to contain it within. You're putting them on the spot. By this, you're actually... You're protecting citizens' rights, I believe, and protecting the cops. The law enforcement doesn't want lawsuits and Freedom of Information Act lawsuits and things about restricting information. They just want a clear definition of what they can and can't do. And the 2725 work group couldn't come up with that, and that's why we're here at the legislature to try to solve this so we don't go year after year with this data floating around and chiefs and sheriffs and cops wondering what they can and can't do with it. And it's really, like I say, under the purview of the data privacy, and we're getting into their area. And I know it's an important subject, but I don't really consider trampling on people's rights as much as just finding a place where this data can be and providing some transparency. They have no reason to hide, and this isn't a KGB effort here. So.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions and lots of concern, but I think my first question is to Chief Goldstein, and I'm kind of like in the same area as Representative Gauthier around the public data concern, because you use words like it could lead to, you know, what if and things like that. So my question is, how has public data information hinder your work?
Chief?
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, I don't want to speak for all of law enforcement, but for me, there have been times where, yes, it has hindered my work, because we don't manufacture investigative cases. Therefore, there are times where we've had information and we've had to release it because it was requested, and you know, we were never able necessarily to follow up on that case because the information was out, but it was out and we move forward. You know, and there have been cases where, and this broadens the scope more than I think we want to get into today, but there are cases where, I'll use myself as an example. My wife and I are having an argument. It's summertime, the windows are open. The neighbors are concerned about the heated argument. They call the police. The police come and they intervene and they find that there's no assault. So no arrests are made. They document the case and they say that, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Goldstein were having an argument about X. Some departments might just have a sentence or two as to what occurred. Some might just tell their dispatcher, we arrived, we assisted, no further follow-up was needed, we cleared, and that's all there is. Our department, on the other hand, is going to write a full-blown report on what transpired. And maybe the argument was about that I just got laid off, and we had serious financial issues brewing, and we were fighting about money, or pick a topic. Anybody now will have access to that data, because it's not a crime. It's just incident data. So it's stored in a record system for 7 years, and anybody that makes a query will get it. And so, is my reputation harmed if I was, you know, let's say I have my current position, public, you know, official, I get laid off or terminated for some reason, and now anybody that wants to know the details of the argument I had with my wife would have it. Now, I'm not saying that this intelligence data wouldn't fall into that bucket, but, you know, I agree that public is good. I'm not interested in hiding anything, but people have to realize that without standards, everything is generally public, and there's a lot of information on people that we collect that, you know, could harm people's reputations if someone made an inquiry. And to your point, not a lot of people do.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this may be a question for Representative Cornish. So can you tell me, where do Ramsey County Sheriff Department, Attorney General, or the law enforcement stand with this bill?
Representative Cornish, it was, do you know where the Ramsey County Sheriff, law enforcement, the Attorney General stand on this bill in general?
I don't know anything about the Attorney General's office on this one, but I thought that the Sheriff Stanek had said that the Sheriff's Association supported the bill. Yeah.
Representative Moran.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my last question and statement has to do with some agreement from the other side over there, from Representative McDonald, who talks about the unintended consequences of this bill. And I am specifically looking at association data, which really concerns me. You know, data that is collected that surround a person's, you know, political, religious, and social views. You know, and as we talk about democracy, as we talk about civil liberty, as we talk about, it's just really concerning to me on that piece. You know, I think we should be transparent and open, but to collect data based on association, I think it really takes us to a place that as a person of color has been when that happens in large numbers. And it just makes me think a little bit about the Somali community, where we have a community of people in Somalia who are starving, women, children, and men. And we have family members here who cannot send money to their family members based on this association. So it's really troubling to me that this is the way we will collect data and also associate individuals.
Chief, go
ahead. Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, the association data is defined, but nothing in the bill gives law enforcement permission to collect data on people's associations unless it's tied to a criminal predicate. So we're not going to track who is a part of the Lions Club or who is a part of, pick your, you know, fraternal group or charitable group or religious group. That's not of an interest. However, if it's tied to a criminal predicate, then yeah, we are interested. And so I to help clarify, this bill is not giving anybody permission to start tracking people based on their associations alone.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
And that, to me, can be one of those unintended consequences of this bill. And I know that may not be the intent, but sometimes the intent goes beyond what is written in the language. Because personally, I believe if someone is collecting an arsenal of weapons and ammunition for their personal business, that is something that needs to be looked into, something that is a red flag for me. But I just truly believe that I have seen just a history of this association and the path that has had on communities of color.
If I might, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you to Sheriff Stanek, because I didn't call attention to it as I should have. In the bill under data prohibitions, line 317, association data may not be maintained by Minnesota law enforcement agencies or shared with any law enforcement agency. So we're prohibiting that from occurring, again, unless there's a criminal predicate. So I think the bill actually helps define it more clearly than how it's defined now.
Representative Mullery.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, first of all, with regard to Representative or Chair Cornish's statement that this comes up in civil law, this committee has jurisdiction over the policy of public safety, and this certainly affects public safety. So I think it really needs a absolutely thorough hearing here. And Representative Johnson, that Senate File Committee was the most dysfunctional thing I've ever seen in my life, and it was set up by going around the policy committees involved. DPS, the commissioner, went around them, went to the Finance Committee and got it set up, and it was set up with extreme people on each side. And I can't believe anybody setting up a committee with nobody that is in the middle and is malleable and looking at something that way. So that was a total disaster. And I guess there are a number of points that I see. I'm not doctrinaire one way or the other. And I see, for instance, right off the bat, I have a difference between severe terrorist activity with and mere criminal activity. That's I can push the envelope one way for extreme terrorist activity as compared to minor criminal activity on their side. There's no distinction in here. I share Representative Moran's concern about how this affects people of color, but I'm not sure whether it's positive or negative. I don't know that it's necessarily a negative, because if it is, the fact is there's more information being collected right now on them, probably, and if this is going to keep that from getting out into the public in a negative way towards them, it's actually a positive that I can see. So I don't necessarily think that this is a negative there. I want to hear more about that, both sides of that. With respect to the issue of Representative Leidiger's freedom and openness, I'm not sure that I totally agree with that. For instance, if I'm a cop and I go over to Representative McDonald's aunts and get information about him that I couldn't get as a cop, although they tell me all about you anyhow, so, but why should that be open to everybody, things about your personal life that I'm getting for a cop's information? In other words, things that no one could normally get about you, except I can get it because I have the rights as a law enforcement investigator. Should that all be open, especially things that aren't in any way criminal? But what if Chief Goldstein, and I want to say something positive about Chief Goldstein on that Senate File Committee. He was one that wasn't quite hardline as much. I think he tried a little bit to come in between. But let's say he's out at a scene and he finds out that there's something going on. He gets called to a cat in a tree. He goes out there and finds out that there was something like extramarital sex going on or whatever, or that there's a divorce. That goes in the report. Should that really be there so that I can go and find out about that? I don't think so. So that's why I disagree with Representative Leidiger about everything being open. I guess the biggest thing problem is that this is really complicated things, and I'm really upset that DPS hasn't set up an interim real working group on this. That Senate file was a total joke, and you knew it the minute it was appointed. There's a lot of us, I think, I can look at members of this committee on both sides that would legitimately try to look at both sides of this and come up with something. And so, Representative Cornish, I'm going to vote against it just this year and try and hope that it isn't, and hope that something is set up over the interim with people that really want to look and ferret out exactly what's going on here. Everybody's not. I was told by a DPS person, I couldn't believe it, that I was so prejudiced on the side of the what might be called anti-law enforcement that I couldn't look at, and he said that I was against certain things, and here I had actually introduced a bill that year, a few months before, to actually do those things. So they don't have a clue at DPS as to what's going on. So I guess I hope that you'll proceed with hearings and allow some kind of a neutral group to set up over the summer and get at this issue. I really believe it's an important issue for us all to look at. I think there's huge consequences to the citizens of Minnesota, especially in the people of color communities. And like I say, I'm not sure that it's not positive for them. I'm not going to take a position that's against them. But we also need to look at the practicality of big terrorist activity that might versus every criminal activity which can be in this bill. So that's where I'm going.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cornish.
That's, I think, why the bill is here. One of the law enforcement people was sitting on the 27-25 work group where this was discussed for a long period of time with many meetings, said it was like sitting through a root canal. And they really never came to a decision. And we could throw it back into a group like that, but I fear that the same thing would happen, and then we continue to flounder without a definition of criminal activity and intelligence data. And one thing to remember about this bill is it's not giving people actually more authority to go out and collect it. It's what information is collected, how do they maintain it and secure it and share it. And so it's not like somebody is going to have any more authority to investigate any association or anything like this. It's just that when they gather the data, who they can share it with, and how they classify it so it stays protected. But I suppose we should move on. We got another bill yet. We haven't even heard from the opposition. So.
Got just a couple of quick questions here, Representative Cornish. Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if this is a question for you, Representative Cornish, or the police chief. The police chief, you mentioned in your comments that you can't store or share the association data, and I can see that in the bill. But association data is defined. Mm-hmm. I don't see specifically where it says you can't collect association data. Does this bill allow you to collect it? And if so, what is done with it if you're not storing it or sharing it with law enforcement?
Chief, you want to take that one?
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, again, in the big bill here, under 3.17, B, association data may not be maintained by a Minnesota law enforcement agency or shared with any law enforcement agency. So there's the prohibition on the collection of that data.
Representative Dow?
And, you know, maybe this is a question for House Research. I'm not an attorney, so I don't. The word maintained to me says that it cannot be stored, but it doesn't. Does that word mean that it can't be collected as well?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, no, it doesn't preclude collection. I suspect the intent of the language was that if they do come across it in their investigation, that they should purge it from the record and not allow it to continue to be affiliated with the person or investigation.
Representative Dow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just a general comment, and maybe this is for the bill author. It looks like there might be a little hole here, and I also noticed that it says it can't be shared with any law enforcement agency, but it doesn't say that it can't be shared with anybody else. So, you know, I guess you could share it with the Girl Scout group and with your church and with, you know, maybe that should be more specific that it can't be shared with any other organization or person.
Thank you, Representative Doubt. And Representative Cornish, just another quick question. Do the county attorneys have a stance on this bill?
No.
I hear a no from the...
No formal stance.
Okay, thank you. Representative Grunhagen, we are really close on time here, but that's my only warning. Other than that, you're unleashed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the testifier, you know, I come at a little different perspective. When I look at some of this in the testimony, what you're trying to do is simply collect information that is suspicious in nature on individuals, which they can have access to, have it in a bucket in a way that across the state it's being handled in a similar way, and before you go take any action on it, there's checks and balances legally that you have to go through before you'd actually act on that information. Is that a correct understanding?
Chief?
Mr. Vice Chair and committee members, yes, in the simple answer, but the first part of your statement was that they would have access to. They wouldn't initially have access to it. Over time they would, but not initially until we vetted out what was going on. But yeah, I would agree with that statement that it is a set of checks and balances. We can't act on it unless we start building that case and moving it into that investigative realm with probable cause and, you know, as we would any criminal investigation.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
You know, to me, this is my initial thought, and I'm open to correction. That's a reasonable balance between civil rights and the ability of law enforcement to protect us from the type of dangers that are out there, especially in the area of terrorism and some of those things, regardless of race, creed, or color, okay? Because ultimately that, I believe, is the law enforcement's primary responsibility is to protect us and create a balance between civil rights and the ability to keep us safe. So those are just observations on the testimony so far. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gruenhagen. Seeing no more questions from members, let's hear from the opposition. I know that Ms. Jackson would like to testify. Ms. Jackson, you want to approach? And then Mr. Feit, you're on deck. And welcome, Ms. Jackson, if you can state your name for the record for us, please.
Good morning. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota. I just have some notes that I'd like to go through. This is a really complicated area of law, and thank you for bringing it forward because it is something that we all need to talk about. There's been a fundamental shift in the way law enforcement is conducted after 9/11. Prior to 9/11, a crime was committed, and then it was investigated, and if it was investigated and there was evidence found, then it was brought to prosecution, it was tried, the person was either convicted or found not guilty, and then they would be punished if they were convicted. The shift that happened after 9/11 is that public pressure to prevent future terrorist activities was to prevent crime. And our system is not built for that. Our system is built, a crime has happened, what do? We investigate and go forward. So law enforcement is under pressure to prevent crime now. And this is really a different thing altogether. And criminal intelligence is linked to preventing crime. So the fundamental question that you, as public policymakers, have to address is that the policy of the state of Minnesota, that our law enforcement is going to work to prevent crime, or are they going to solve crimes that have already happened? And I don't have an answer to you for that. Because it's new territory, and it's a different way of looking at the world. The second thing that I want to talk about is this is already going on. Their criminal intelligence is being gathered. It's being gathered definitely by the FBI, and to a certain extent by law enforcement here in Minnesota. We have essentially three buckets in the Data Practices Act. We have public data. We have private data, which if it's on me, I can see it, but if Representative Slocum wanted to look at it, she couldn't see it. And then confidential, where I know it exists, but I can't see it either. And what's happened is when the Data Practices Act was written, these buckets were made as if they were made out of steel. But the way they're being treated is if they're buckets made out of fresh clay. And so when something comes in that isn't really clear, they kind of push the bucket to make room for it. And I think what Chief Goldstein very eloquently talks about is that when they get information that doesn't really fit in one of those buckets, they kind of have to push the bucket and say, well, we might make up a fake criminal investigation because this isn't something that we're ready to release for public safety purposes. or we'll put it public and hope that nobody knows it's there. I want to talk a little bit about this Mall of America situation that happened. The Mall of America was, prior to this investigation, gathering, they would do their security things, and then they would take their data and they would give it to the city of Bloomington. And the city of Bloomington would say, well, here's a crime, we'll have to investigate it, or they'd just sit on it. Well, a news agency did a data practices request. And when the city of Bloomington got that data practices request, they said, well, what do we do with this? Technically, under the law, this is public data. And the data went out. And a news report was then issued, and it was on Minnesota, or it was on National Public Radio, and it talked about really serious things that were happening at the Mall of America, very serious racial profiling going on there. People who were African American and people who were looked as though they were Muslim were targeted by mall security and followed and harassed and detained. And this is something the public needs to know about. This is a gross violation of our trust with law enforcement if we think that if you're going to go shopping at the Mall of America, you better not look Muslim because you're going to be harassed if you go there. And that's very wrong. But by the same token, the Mall of America said the same data that you sent out also has all of our security plans on it. And, you know, it went to a news agency, and the news agency didn't publish a story about how can you blow up the Mall of America. They published about how people were treated there. But the concern was that same data also would tell you where the security checkpoints and everything were in the thing. So that's a situation where it was put in the public bucket, but that didn't quite fit. But the confidential investigative things didn't fit either. So law enforcement is doing this kind of thing, and here's a second public policy question for you. If we're going to acknowledge that this is happening, we can acknowledge that this type of information is being gathered, and we can control how it's gathered, and that's what this bill is an attempt to do. Or we can say, no, it needs to remain public. We need to not have this type of confidential classification, and we need to really start enforcing the Data Practices Act and stop these sort of twisted pushing out of the different buckets, because that's against policy in Minnesota. So I want to repeat that. We have a policy question about whether we want to solve crime or whether we want to prevent crime. And we have a policy question about whether we want to acknowledge the fact that law enforcement gathers intelligence data and we will control that with clear set rules, or whether we say that it is wrong to gather this type of intelligence altogether. And those are public policy questions that I can't answer for you. I did a little research. This is the way California deals with this issue. This is very complicated. I had an intern. I said, well, how does California deal with this? And this got plunked on my desk yesterday afternoon. I have a file like this from the Senate File 2725 work group that's three times this big. It's huge. And all of it is relevant. This is a complicated issue. This bill is a simplification of what other jurisdictions do. The feds have a law. This is based on a federal rule, and basically it is stripped of a lot of the protections that are in the federal rule. So as the bill is written, and basically it is stripped of a lot of the protections that are in the federal rule. So as the bill is written, it's extremely flawed. I'm going to raise some of my general concerns about if we decide that we're going to acknowledge and control intelligence data, here are some of the things that you have to think about. The definitions need to be a lot more detailed. There are a lot of terms in here that are not defined. Who has the right to know this information, and who has the need to know this information? That's not spelled out. If the agency has this data, who in the agency can look at it, and when can they look at it? The need to know and the right to know. The criminal predicate. There are certain types of crimes where criminal intelligence is primarily used. That's in gang crimes, in drug crimes, and in preventing terrorism. One of the reason the Senate File 2725 work group came into being was concerns about GangNet in Ramsey County. And GangNet was a database that was put together to gather information on gangs and then fed into the gang pointer file system, which is something created by statute. The problem with GangNet, though, is basically it gathered up every African-American boy under 30 in men and boys in St. Paul. And it was riddled with racial profiling. And the St. Thomas Law Center, or St. Thomas Law School, did a review of that and found just incredible racial profiling in there. They sat down with the sheriff, and I think two-thirds of the records that were in GangNet were purged, and then they worked on it. And so this was a problem that existed. And the impetus for Senate File 2725 was to look at these types of databases. In the course of the conversation, criminal intelligence as a subject matter also came up, and we did a lot of talking about that. But the real problems of racial profiling that existed is the reason that we put this group together in the first place, or that the legislature did. So we've got gangs, drugs, and terrorism. But I also would like to remind you that adultery is a crime in Minnesota. And so if someone is suspected of committing adultery, that is a criminal predicate for opening a file and gathering information on where somebody's going. Marching without a permit is also a crime in Minnesota. So if you're gathering together to march to protest something and you don't have the appropriate permit, that's a crime, and you can open a file. That's a criminal predicate. So the criminal predicate in this bill is extremely low. And there are a lot of things that are crimes in Minnesota that go directly to our First Amendment rights and to our association rights. And in the bill, there's not a prohibition, a blanket prohibition on in association things. It has to be linked to criminal activity. But that criminal predicate is so low that it could be just almost anything. This data needs to be audited, both internally and externally, to see whether it's filled with errors and who's accessing it and what it's being used for, and whether it's being used to solve the crimes for which it was intended or whether it was being used to spy on people. And so it needs strong auditing, both on an internal control, who's doing it, and an external control, is it being used properly. There's no mechanism in this bill for correcting errors in data. So if there's a file created on me erroneously, it's there. And it's going to stay there, and it can be shared. And there's no mechanism for fixing that in this bill. The retention schedule needs to be strict. The retention schedule in here is loose at best. There is a retention schedule, but it needs to be, how long can you hold on to this data? Sanctions. What happens to somebody when they misuse their power to gather intelligence data? And that needs to be spelled out. And then sharing. One of the problems is that the FBI, if the data is shared with the FBI, the FBI is very inscrutable and opaque. It's very, very difficult to get information out of the FBI. With a Minnesota agency, they're subject to the Data Practices Act, which gives us much greater information and access to information than you can ever get from the FBI. So I'll go through that list one more time. Definitions, the right to know, the need to know, the criminal predicate, audit, correcting errors, the retention schedule, sanctions, and sharing. So those are all items that need to be considered if you make a public policy decision that this is something that you want to acknowledge and control. So I'll stand for questions.
Right, thank you, Ms. Jackson. Representative Gruenhagen, is your question specific to Ms. Jackson?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Jackson, for your testimony. You know, just a couple comments. One, I would disagree with your basic premise. I don't see 9/11 as a crime. I see it as an act of war. That Bin Laden and his cronies had declared war on the United States, the mistake we made, we didn't take it seriously. And in war, prevention is a valid principle. And collecting information to prevent attacks on your citizens and the safety of the people that you're trying to protect is important. I do tend to agree with some of your comments about areas to be tightened up. You know, I'm not an attorney, I'm a lay person, but the criminal predicate, the sanctions, some of those things, removing errors, I think that is okay. valid information. But the basic premise is we are at war, we continue to be, and war creates a different footing than just a criminal activity as far as I'm concerned. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Jackson.
Representative, we're not talking about soldiers. We're talking about policemen. And I'm also not saying that I didn't make the recommendation one way or another about whether it's prevention or investigation. I'm stating a historical fact that law enforcement has changed to looking more at prevention than at investigation. And that's just a shift that's happened in our society. But we're not talking about soldiers here. We're talking about policemen. And there's a big difference. They are peace officers.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Greenhagen.
Part of the soldier's responsibility is to defend the homeland, and we're in a different type of war that we haven't been before. There is no drawn battle lines. The battle lines are in our communities, in our state, and in our cities across this nation, and we see that in the Middle East. We see it, and it's coming here to our shores, and I do think giving law enforcement, which has to be a part of this, since it's right here in our own homeland, certain abilities to look at suspicious behavior is a valid principle to discuss and support, as long as there's some restrictions on taking legal action with that. And I want to protect people's privacy as much as anybody, but there is a balance there, I believe.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Jackson, you referenced some reports that were, quote, riddled with racial profiling, unquote. What reports were those?
Ms. Jackson?
Representative, the St. Thomas, Ms. Perry has it right there. She's holding it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Jackson, whatever reports they are they available to us?
Yes, they are, and your staff does have that.
Ms. Jackson, it strikes me that you raised the phrase racial profiling to dissuade someone for perhaps voting for this bill. Would you do two things, and very briefly, though, please? Number one, define it, and number two, give me a couple of examples from that report that you consider racial profiling.
Ms. Jackson.
Representative, I think a better term is over-policing. I probably over-policing of certain populations. Racial profiling is choosing people and based on their race, not on any criminal suspicion. What was found was that, and I'll be honest, I haven't looked at that report for about 18 months, so I'm not real up to date on it. What was found, though, is that the baseline for a name being put into this GangNet system was very low, that if you were seen in the company of a known gang member, you were gathered, your name was put into GangNet. And then GangNet was used, for instance, there was a prohibition of people, this is ancient history, so forgive me if I'm slightly off on this, but I believe it was on a Cinco de Mayo celebration. People who were in GangNet were barred from attending the Cinco de Mayo celebration. Now, who got into GangNet was primarily people who had been seen with other gang members. So if your first cousin was a known gang member and you went to his birthday party and a policeman happened to see you going to his birthday party, you could have gotten to GangNet. And so it's association data and it's also race data that was used to put names in there. And in the investigation, and I would encourage you to read the report, it's beautifully written, and they worked very closely with the Sheriff's Department to get proper information and everything. It was very well done. But the problem was that so many people erroneously got into that database, and then it was used for preventative purposes later on, so the people who were in there were over-policed. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, I hope it does, too.
So, Mr. Chair, can I speak to that?
Well, Representative Moran, there's a couple people on the list real quick. I want to make sure that you have an opportunity here. And Representative McDonald, Representative Johnson are on the list. Are these specific questions for Ms. Jackson? We do have one more bill to get to. And
Mr. Chair, they are.
Okay, go ahead, Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, my thoughts on this bill is tepid at best. However, you made a comment that was certainly important, and I wanted to find out for myself that if there's any erroneous information or misleading, it's there forever. And I want House Research to perhaps correct my trepidations and your testimony that is not the case in sections in line 2.2 down to 6.2 down to 6.5, where it says the procedures shall provide for the periodic review of data and the destruction of any data that is misleading, obsolete, or otherwise unreliable, and shall require any recipient agencies to be advised of any errors or corrections. So, Mr. Diebel, could you substantiate that for me?
Mr. Diebel, do you have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I think this is for the this is guidance when for the entity that maintains a system that has criminal intelligence data, and this is setting up the standards for which they must audit and maintain that data. So they would be required to, and of course it would require acknowledge of there being a mistake in the data for someone to enforce their rights. To the extent they would self-police themselves, that's what they're doing here, but it would require someone to have knowledge that there's something maintained that shouldn't be, to bring either a private cause of action or to bring a notify the county attorney of a criminal violation of the Data Practices Act. So it's intended to protect the data and put in safeguards against maintaining data that is not permitted, but does require some sort of knowledge that the mistake was made, and I don't know that they would have procedures for calling that out on themselves beyond what's in the audit procedure.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Well, I think if there is data that is misleading or inaccurate, I hope that maybe we can address the bill that if that's the case, then that material should be completely omitted and struck from the data. I think we'd all would agree that if there's misleading information on an individual, it's false and not true, that we don't want it in the data. Wouldn't you all agree?
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Jackson, you can answer that yes, no, or probably, but it seems to me that the horses have kind of left the barn with respect to intelligence gathering, criminal data, and the like, and that there is a need to establish standards for collecting, storing, and sharing criminal justice data in one way or another. I'm not sure if this is a bill for it, but would you agree that it'd be rather difficult just to go back to enforcing Chapter 13 and not having some kind of uniform standards in place?
Ms. Jackson?
Just briefly.
I think that's something for you guys to decide. We have real concerns about how this type of data can be abused. But it is the truth that it's being gathered in other states by the feds and sort of quasi-legally in Minnesota. So I don't have an answer to that. That's above my pay grade.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I would like to speak in reference to the GAIN Task Force and maybe bring some clarity or understanding to what has happened. So I'm a mother of four sons. I have four young men who are, and you know, St. Paul's is a small city and there's not a huge population of African Americans. You know, so they're gone to school, you know, they play ball together, they swim together, they know each other. But if my sons were, and you know, they're friends, they're associates, but if my son were to be seen with a member who the gang task force has labeled as a gang member, because my son maybe are walking down the street with that member, and whether they are really a member or not is up to the device of that person or individual. But if my son were to be seen with any person who was on that gang task force, they would be associated and also be labeled as a gang member. And that has huge implications for them as they continue to go to school, to engage in the community, that they are profiled. They are immediately part of a database of young men who are being profiled. Now, is that right? I have to, you know, disagree with Representative Mullery over there around seeing some good in that. because we have a history of this type of profiling taking place based on association with and of someone else. And many times these are just law-abiding people who are doing the right thing, but just because of who they are. And that may be hard for some people to take into that, you know, that type of concept that, you know, we won't love. And I respect peace officers. I respect people who have been trained, who are professional in what they do, because it's not an easy job to do. But to have them police themselves, you know, to go back to line 6-2, and to acknowledge that some wrongdoing has taken place, or to acknowledge that maybe there's wrong information, that is up to, you know, who's going to say that, that I collected wrong information? I mean, maybe it happens, maybe it should happen, maybe we want it to happen, but in large numbers sometimes it just doesn't happen for whatever reason. So I do. I have concerns with this bill. I have the concern that we have a body of police officers who is coming together to bring a perspective of the best intent for this bill. It's really, really disturbing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cornish.
If it gets some comfort to members, maybe it won't totally, but we're going to change the motion on this to send it without recommendation to civil law because of the questions, but I would still like to move it on. And we've got another bill up too, and we got to make deadlines. We'll end up probably having to stay over the noon hour, but because we haven't got anything reserved for tonight, that has to make re-referrals. So, and we still got another opposition testimony.
We do, and without keeping that in mind, Representative Mulroney,
Mr. Chairman, I definitely want to ask a question, and I also want to clarify. I don't understand where Representative Moran came. Totally. What I said didn't get into what she said. I said, and I'm probably on, if they're taking down license plates or anything, I'm sure I'm on list, because I have a lot of friends on the north side that I go to their houses and somebody's in a gang there. And just, so, but my real issue was, do you, and this is being portrayed as, but it's going to expand something against people of color, and I'm as you probably heard, I'm not gung-ho for this bill, to say the least. I'm going to vote against it for sure right now, but I also see that this bill doesn't expand in any way, does it, taking information on whether it's people of color or anybody else. I'm not seeing where this expands that. Does this not actually do the opposite and keep, not the opposite, but does it not keep information away from being public, which would harm the lives of, in other words, let's say I was on one of these lists. Right now, that's public. If I go out to get a job, that could affect me. Whereas, if this goes through, if I go out to get a job, the public doesn't know it, do they? And so, I see no advancement of what's already happening as far as collecting data. It seems to me like it actually would help me if I'm on the database, in that it's the public doesn't have it, and so I wouldn't be turned down for a job or something like that. Am I wrong on reading it that way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, first of all, I want to make it clear, GangNet has been abolished. Mm-hmm. As a result of this report and other things, it's no longer in existence. So this is a historic example. As far as the confidentiality of the data, the concern that we're concerned with is not a potential employer doing a search of this data. The concern is over-policing. If you are on in a database where you are flagged as being a dangerous gang member and you change lanes without using your signal, the police response to that is going to be very different than if you are a suburban housewife changing lanes without using your signal. The chances of, first of all, you being stopped are higher. And if you're stopped, being searched would be higher, whether they make you get out of the car, whether they do a pat down, and things. The level of policing, if you are on a database, the police can access, the type of policing that you are subjected to will change. So you will be over-policed. That's just one of the concerns that's done.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. I don't see anything in this that allows more database on that. Am I wrong? Does this allow a lot more? Oh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, what's happened is we're conflating GangNet with what this is. GangNet doesn't exist anymore. One of the problems with GangNet was that people were over-policed. If you want to get into the concern about the police gathering data, that's a whole nother conversation, and I don't, you know, that goes into privacy and the power of the police and everything like that, and I don't think we have time to go into that today, but it certainly is a concern. But it's a very broad philosophical type of debate, and I can't answer you concisely on that.
Thank you, Ms. Chastain. Mr. Feit?
My name's Dan Feit, and I have a really, really important handout, and it needs to be seen by everybody on this committee.
Mr. Feit, Mr. Feit, that must go through the chair. Mr. Feit,
this is the type of data
you will listen to the chairman of this committee, or you will be escorted out of this room.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
I am giving you an opportunity to speak and testify, but you will listen to what I have to say, and you will follow what the chair directs, or you will not have that ability.
Mr. Chair, as a taxpayer and a citizen and a participant in public policy, as well as somebody who worked covering issues at the state legislature for 4 years, I have to show an example of the type of data which we may not be able to have access to, which in this particular case shows, for example, through data discovery, how local police were discussing how illegal government operations could be ensured and how protesters could be expected to sue. And I also have examples here, which I handed out, which made it halfway across the committee, of the Homeland Security critical infrastructure tracking of Occupy Wall Street. And I think that's very important because that document is an example of tracking of an organization that I'm affiliated with. And so I think the topic of critical infrastructure is pivotally important, and we need to have an open discussion on that. And I also want to add, I tried to, you know, closely observe the SF 2725 work group. It was pretty frustrating because all the members of the work group are, you know, over the age of 40, I think, at least over the age of 35. And so outside people that weren't one of those groups only got 5 minutes as individuals to testify. When there are so many different important issues to bear, it's just very troubling that the policymaking latitude keeps decreasing, and I think that's very important to consider. So, and I'm sorry about the drama, but why can't I have any handouts today?
Mr. Feit,
is that in House rules?
Yes, Mr. Feit, it has to go through the chair, and you may approach any member when this committee is over and give them any information that you would like to give them.
And the reality, simply put, is it's only a tiny example. There are really hundreds of pages of pertinent material that ought to be looked at, and this is just one simple sampling. But I think it's really pivotally important that, you know, we look carefully at these things and try to have an open process. One of the major things which has been troubling about the different iterations of this bill is that it does lower the bar for criminal predicates. Reasonable possibility can mean essentially anything which is in a police officer's imagination. So, for example, if a police officer imagines, well, this person could commit civil disobedience in the future, that's a crime. And so all of their personal life is totally fair game. And it's very troubling. It's troubling that it's like I'm one of the people that a lot of people tend to come to say, like, look, I'm being spied on. I'm being, like, shadowed. Like, I set up a chat channel for Occupy Wall Street when it started, and the FBI sent Sabu, this Lulzsec guy, to lurk in my channel. So that kind of targeting is incredibly troubling, and the lack of systemic predicates and transparency in this whole system is just, it's really quite troubling. So the problem is that it makes it acceptable for law enforcement to build permanent dossiers on people if they believe that they will engage in civil disobedience. That appears to be the text of the bill, and I don't believe that's a good idea. I think that the overall trend in the last decade has been a certain expansion of the intelligence system over the formal political system, and so the idea of defining critical infrastructure as something which any opposition to critical infrastructure, which are basically large, usually fairly powerful private businesses, the modeling of that as a quasi-terrorist type of thing is very dangerous, I think, to our whole civilization, because it means that we don't evolve. Like, the opposition to critical infrastructure might be necessary. Like, there might be a coal power plant that people want to protest, and, you know, a lot of people believe coal is really damaging. And so to say that that's critical infrastructure, that anybody opposed to that coal could not, you know, be allowed to do that without being tracked by the police, and then having that intelligence specifically passed to the owners of the coal plant is a very troubling development that I think will really harm the forward evolution of our whole society. And also, a very prominent member of Minnesota law enforcement, I asked them, you know, doesn't this mean that critical infrastructure is supposed to last forever? And they said yes, and that's impossible. And so that's the kind of troubling assumption that's really baked into this whole system. And so part of the reason, well, one of the things I've been involved with, and I am only speaking for myself, not anybody else, but one of the things I've been involved with is the Occupy Wall Street protests, which started on September 17th. And part of the reason that that enormous protest resonated well across the country and here in Minnesota is because a decade of fusion center development has not made it more difficult for the financial industry to commit crimes. Like, the targeting of fusion centers is very directed toward people that oppose critical infrastructure, oppose large business practices. It isn't really directed at powerful people. And that's an incredibly troubling pattern. I mean, somebody told me that they were followed from the Capitol yesterday and photographed. And we don't know. It could have been somebody working for the banks. It could have been the police. But the idea that that becomes more secret under this bill, that there's less transparency, is incredibly troubling. I know that somebody else was tailed home from work within the last 10 days in Hennepin County. And so I don't know if that was, could be Minneapolis police, could be feds, it could be the sheriff's people, I'm not sure. But I think that this bill would reclassify that activity. And so, I mean, did you have any classified data activity in the last 2 weeks?
Mr. Like, Fye,
in terms of data collection? Please. I'm just, you know, it's important. It's relevant to this bill. It should be talked about. So the closed process of 2725, the fact that these processes are becoming so closed and the auditing becomes so closed is just incredibly troubling. Another thing, too, is that it doesn't deal with when governments do illegal things, or it has a faulty assumption that governments outside jurisdictions are always totally lawful. And, I mean, my grandfather, Daniel S. Fite, was this, you know, in the legislature for more than 20 years. And he understood that other states could sometimes be corrupt. The, you know, Tammany Hall machine, the Taft-Hartley machine, for example. And, you know, so there's a real troubling assumption that governments are always trustworthy. And I don't think that's valid. Also, it's becoming really difficult to travel into Canada. Canada has access to a lot of different files through these data sharing systems. And the more data that's retained by the state, the more difficult it is to travel into Canada. So we have a free trade agreement, but we don't actually have free travel anymore. And I think that's really bad. So it's bigger than just the United States. North America is actually becoming, apparently, a control grid. And that's really troubling. So I think the intelligence system is really taking over the formal political process and the election system. I would ask you, how many of you think that you'll be watched before your election and be shadowed by law enforcement? And will you be able to get data discovery to see that that's happening? Because I know that that happens on a routine way, like without predicates, outside of their jurisdictions. And that's not going to be transparent under bills like this. I think that's really quite troubling. And so also another thing, too, is that by allowing law enforcement to keep permanent dossiers on people, especially if they think, oh, under a reasonable possibility, you might commit a crime in the future. That helps law enforcement find psychological hooks to control people, to turn them into informants, to affect what they're doing in political organizations. And I mean, I know for a fact that that's already happening, like, right now, like, day to day, week to week. Like, I hear about it directly. And so the idea that that would be expanded is troubling. And I also think, you know, so much of this data stuff involves just really large Microsoft Access database systems. And, you know, generally speaking, I should point out Microsoft's software is not usually secure, that you can get into Microsoft Access databases without logging if you just don't use the client application that you're supposed to use.
So there's issues with software design.
Mr. Fight?
In all of this.
Mr. Fight?
Two quick points, and then I'm done.
Okay, I need to know how much you've been on for 10 minutes, and I want to make sure you're talking to the bill.
So I think it also says projects must not interfere with politics. Like, there's this whole notion of projects, like intelligence projects, and I think that there's, you know, troubling aspects there, because that doesn't mean that they can't collect information on politics. It just says that they're not supposed to interfere. And that just doesn't seem narrowly tailored enough. So there's really an evolution of a closed policy system, an evolution of an authoritarian system, and it goes across the left-right spectrum. If you stick out, if you say anything critical of critical infrastructure owners, the gates are wide open. And it's incredibly troubling. And I just please beg of everybody to have an open process, to not just have little panels like SF2725, and to, you know, make sure that we are still able to use the Minnesota Data Practices Act to find out how illegal government operations are structured. So that's it, roughly. I'd love to have a discussion about that stuff. And I mean, if anybody thinks that the system's been working great, that, like, you know, the federal government is good at dealing with financial crime, raise your hand right now. Does anybody think the federal government's good at dealing with financial crime? Anybody? See, that's not a lot of confidence in the room, guys. That's the problem. That's right at the heart of this. So, it's troubling stuff. It's really terrifying. Be right on the front lines of this. You hear it all the time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fight. Representative Cornish, would you like to move the bill?
Yeah, I would like to renew my motion, only to change the motion to House File 2470 be passed to the Civil Law Committee without recommendation.
Okay. Representative Cornish moves that we refer this to Civil Law without recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
You didn't offer the members a chance to ask many questions. You didn't ask.
Mr. Fight, there were no members that asked questions. You certainly have the ability to discuss it with any member after this committee. But thank you for your testimony.
If the testifiers for the next bill will come to the table and the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2435 and recommend its passage and referral to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, House File 2435, Representative Woodard, begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll kind of be brief in my comments about the Fusion Center. We've got some good testifiers here to talk a little bit more about the MnJAC system. But today, the Fusion Center is fully funded by the federal government and has no state funding whatsoever. It's not in our statute and not really under our purview as to what they do. So this bill would actually put the Fusion Center into state statute so that we can continue to talk about what their functions are. And it is the only agency today, unless I'm corrected under testimony, that the federal government is allowed to give us information, top secret information regarding terrorist activity. So it is our funnel from the federal government so that we can understand those issues. There are questions about what MnJAC does, and I think those are good questions for us to explore. And I would like to say that we are working with some of the privacy advocates here, including Mr. Neumeister, to figure out ways in which we can allay some of his fears as well about the Joint Analysis Center. And we'll be discussing those between this committee and the time it gets to civil law. So I wanted to bring that out as well. Without any further conversation, I guess, Representative Cornish, I'd like to refer to my testifiers.
Okay, who would like to begin?
Mr. Dinesky, if you would state your name and title and begin, if keep it short and to the point, if you would, please.
I will, Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Mark Dinesky. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. In a few moments, VCA Superintendent Setter here will give you a brief overview of MNJAC. Before he does so, I'd just like to make a few points. Among the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission was the establishment of centers capable of sharing information in order to prevent terrorism and criminal activity. The designated Minnesota Fusion Center, commonly known as you hear over and over here, is MNJAC, it's a Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, was established in 2005 under the Department of Public Safety's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. It was restructured and moved under the DPS Bureau of Criminal Apprehension in 2007. Its existence was established under a memo of understanding among the participating agencies. Since its inception, MNJAC has matured and grown into an entity that provides invaluable services to the organizations entrusted with protecting the citizens of our country, our state, our infrastructure, and even our government. This initiative is a priority for the Department of Public Safety. We, like the 49 other states and 22 urban areas that operate fusion centers, believe that the services that are provided by fusion centers are essential to public safety in the rapidly changing world that we live in. However, we also understand that there are many questions surrounding the who, what, when, where, why, of how MNJAC actually functions and operates. And believe me when I say we welcome those questions. And I do trust that Superintendent Setter's presentation will answer some of them. MNJAC is one of the few fusion centers that operates without state funding. MNJAC operations are funded primarily through federal funds. These federal grant fundings are indeed being reduced, and consequently, the future and viability of MNJAC in our state needs to be determined. We believe this bill is the first step in that process, which would allow the development of a fusion center system that meets the needs of public safety as well as the concerns of privacy and accountability. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would have BCA Superintendent proceed with his overview.
Before we do that, Mr. Chair, Mr. Dasky, we do have an A1 amendment that I failed to move that I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative, go ahead and move your amendment.
The A1 amendment actually comes to us from the Sheriff's Department, and my understanding there's no opposition here from the BCA or the Department of Public Safety either. But on page 1, line 7, before the word government, we would insert the word state so that it clarifies that we're talking about the state fusion center.
Okay, Representative Woodard. Representative Woodard removes the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead, sir. State your name and title.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Wade Setter. I'm the Superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide a quick overview of the Fusion Center that we operate since 2007. Just as a quick overview, and you've heard this, I think, through some of Commissioner Dinesky's comments, the Fusion Centers are really a direct result on a national level as a result of the 9/11 Commission recommendations. And the reason for that was that there were disparate pieces of information that the 9/11 Commission found that could have potentially prevented that devastating attack in our country. So they decided to, through federal funding, set up a nationwide network. Today there are 72 fusion centers in the United States. It's a definition from the Fusion Center Guidelines, and it's really a collaborative effort of two or more agencies that provide resources, expertise, and information to the center. And the goal is maximizing their ability to detect, prevent, investigate, and respond to criminal and terrorist activity. We really are using the Fusion Center to provide a mechanism through which the government, law enforcement, public, and the private sector can share information that has a common purpose to prevent homeland, to protect the homeland and prevent criminal activity. And I'd like to just talk about what it's not, because I think it's easily confused. Our Fusion Center that operates currently has about 17 employees. None of them are sworn law enforcement. It's not a watch office. It's not a state emergency operations center. It's not an operational center, and they do not conduct investigations. They share information, and they're the facilitated process of that. It's a support center that's analysis-driven, so finding information, much of it comes from the public domain, the public sector, and looking for trends or issues that may be of interest, particularly to the law enforcement community, and then redistributing the information. They proactively seek to identify these threats before they occur. Rely primarily on open source and then local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies to provide raw data for analysis. Priorities is to receive information from the federal partners. Since their inception, as Representative Woodard said, our fusion center is a designated fusion center by the governor's declaration and is the primary method for law enforcement in Minnesota to receive classified information from our federal law enforcement partners. And those would be particularly related to counterterrorism type events. They go through a formal process, try to assess local implications, and ultimately share that information with local partners. and gathering the information from state and local partners. This graphic, and I know you had Mr. Holquist distribute this to the committee before, really shows a graphic representation of how the Fusion Center serves as the nexus for information from not only the federal government in the green in the bottom, but laterally from other state fusion centers around the country, and works closely with the Minneapolis Office of the FBI and U.S. Department of Homeland Security, as well as local, state, federal, tribal law enforcement, and other government officials and first responders. Just a graphic to show around the country. Now, I did recently read the testimony from a gentleman representing the National Fusion Center Directors Association, and the updated number is there are 77 local fusion centers around the country as of last week. As I said, we're Minnesota's Fusion Center by designation. We are established by Department of Homeland Security grants in 2005 and structured under Homeland Security Emergency Management within the Department of Public Safety. What became immediately apparent is because we're sharing law enforcement data, which has, under Chapter 13, a confidential classification, and Homeland Security and Emergency Management is not a law enforcement agency, the administrative decision was to move it and restructure it under the BCA since we are a bona fide law enforcement agency. Here is the mission statement that has been developed by our user group. It's to collect, evaluate, analyze, and disseminate information regarding organized criminal, terrorist, and all hazard activity in the state of Minnesota. And I think the most important part of it is the last one as well, complying with state and federal law to ensure the rights and privacy of all. The overview of the positions, 13 agencies represented, they were on the initial graphic. They are subject to DPS supervision, BCA, the director of the Fusion Center reports directly to me. And we do abide by Minnesota data practices law as they exist today. Goal, information exchange, and that's really what it is. It's an information sharing mechanism, and that's the intended purpose of it. Provides interstate connection. That becomes very important, not only on a regional level, but on a national level. And it's statewide in scope, and that, I think, is helpful. We have approximately 87 sheriff's departments in the state and almost 400 additional law enforcement agencies, and it becomes very difficult, as you might imagine, in order to share information when trends are noticed on a statewide level. And then, of course, we provide training. A privacy policy, we have actually a privacy policy in May 2008 that was passed by a committee that was deliberately selected, including advocates for privacy, the media, and we were the first amongst the fusion centers on a national level to have an established privacy policy, and we follow that. That is the guiding document in how we address data. They most recently updated that policy in December 2011. We have had two audits, both in 2010. We had an audit of the data within the Fusion Center to see how it complies with the state law that was conducted by a city attorney that is knowledgeable in state data practices laws. We also have had an audit to see if we comply with those federal standards because of the federal data practices, and that's one of the complicating factors for us is negotiating this distinction between federal and state laws. And some changes were made based on the recommendations. They produce products, law enforcement-only briefs, which are non-public data for law enforcement. Those are typically restricted to active investigations. Weekly, daily briefs, which are predominantly public data that are distributed to not only the public safety but private sectors. Special bulletins, a great example of that was when the Times Square bombing occurred about a year and a half ago, is that information is coming out in the media, and then, of course, information came from the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, and we were able to distribute that through our distribution network to public safety officials throughout the state of Minnesota. We also
How many slides you got
left? Two left, sir.
Okay.
I'll conclude with this. Why act now? We are federally funded right now at 100%. We're one of the only fusion centers in the country that does not have any state general fund investment. There are shrinking federal grant dollars, and we realize this is important. And so by putting it into the 299C, which is the BCA statute, it will be part of our budget discussions as we go into the next biennial budget development.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. There are letters from the sheriff, from Sheriff Stanek, and the city of Minneapolis, and a few other letters in here as well, Department of Corrections, in support of this. If in the interest of time, we don't necessarily have to have them testify unless the committee would like to hear from them.
Yeah, we've got room for 6 minutes here. Do we have any questions from any members here? And then there's two people in opposition. We're going to give them 1 minute apiece. They'll have to abide by the time limit. And questions, Representative Muller, did you have one?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Woodard, I'm concerned that we don't have time to really figure this thing out and what it does. I'm concerned about a lot of the info that goes through here, and I guess as I explained before, I'm not very doctrinaire. I can see that there's a lot of issues on this. Would you at all consider dividing it into, I guess I can go along with the real the most serious things like terror activity and maybe extreme serious criminal before we are able to sort it out, but right now it's just open to all criminal activity, and it's the same as, it sounds a little bit like the discussions we had on the index and what we should be doing with that, and I guess I think it should be fleshed out a lot before we allow this to just be for all kinds of stuff and everybody involved in it and have their information going. I can see a distinction between that and really, you know, very terrorist activity or extreme criminal activity. So,
well, Representative Mulray and Mr. Sutter may want to kind of weigh in on this too, but I am open to that discussion, which we are, having right now with the Department of Public Safety and also with advocates like Mr. Neumeister to kind of come to a conclusion there between here and civil law. I think that some of the criminal activity that MNJAC is involved in today that has been described is actually legitimate, but I'm open to learning a little bit more about that in the during the process here to find out if there are things that we can kind of tighten that up in. And Mr. Sutter, you may have some additional or not?
Let's see. We got like 4 or 5 minutes now. I'd like to bring up the opposition 1 minute apiece. The opposition didn't sign up, but as a courtesy, we'll allow you to testify 1 minute apiece if you'll agree to that time limit. Why don't you come on up?
Thank you.
State your name and title and begin.
My name's Sam Richards. I'm in a couple different activist groups as well as in the U.S. military, and part of my job in the military is intelligence analysis, but that's just to give you some context of the situation. I'm speaking in opposition to this because I feel that fusion centers are a huge violation of several founding principles of this country. Not only is it against the federal system, in which the federal government and the state and local and all the other jurisdictions do not directly interact, I feel that it is a trifling of our rights, going down the Bill of Rights, and I would hate to see this bill continue to fund the fusion center efforts in this county, in this state. I don't have much time. I had a whole thing planned out, but I just have strong opposition to this as a concerned Minnesotan, as a member of the service.
Okay, thank you, sir. Thank you for your service. And anybody else? 1 minute beginning now.
Good to be with you again. I did actually call yesterday the CA and the Committee of Legislative Assistant. The problem is that the entire Fusion Center design philosophy is basically a closed process, and it lacks oversight. It doesn't really effectively sift through and release open source intelligence. If they just posted what they were sending out on their website, and I think that would be a great amendment to this bill, just publish all this stuff that they're sending out into industries, I think that would be incredibly helpful. Because, again, the whole concept of critical infrastructure makes the government much too closely aligned to the owners of private businesses. It's a very faulty, dangerous assumption. And an open process where everybody could basically pose questions to the Fusion Center and demand answers from both federal and state law enforcement officials, like every 2 weeks, anybody could ask them to answer questions. That would be an open process that would actually do a much better job of turning law enforcement to address much more entrenched systematic issues. There's a very troubling 2006 FBI spying camp operation that occurred in Winona, which documents were released about, and so Fusion Centers help federal agents that don't have enough to do around the Midwest to collect statistical accomplishments through labeling people as terrorists and then investigating them and then collecting statistical accomplishments to advance their careers when none of this is actually terrorism.
Right.
The 2006 is a great example of that, and I question the ability of the Fusion Center system to deal with entrenched financial corruption, including the routine laundering of billions of dollars of drug money through the banking system, and specifically I want to know if the Fusion Center will deal with the systematic laundering of drug money through the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis and Hennepin County.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming today. All right. No more. We got enough. And it wasn't on our list. Thanks anyway. No, we can't allow any more. We got to move on. We already allowed two that we didn't have on the list. All right. Now, Who else? Let's see. Representative Woodard. Members, Representative Muller, have problems, you know, somewhat with the bill, too, and moving this quickly. It's going to go to civil law, and there are some amendments. One thing that does trouble me is the First Amendment, where we restrict it to state government. There's a possibility of having another or a couple of fusion centers, and I don't want to limit the funding or the direction to just state government, and so I want you to think about that as it progresses through civil law and onto the floor, and so and do some more work on it. But Representative Muller, did you have anything to add before we?
Mr. Chairman, I just think in its present state it shouldn't be going on. That's just my view. And we haven't had the chance to discuss it as our caucus on this, and so I'd welcome either. Well, there's only two left from our caucus, but
this we're not creating a new center here. This one does already exist, and they're collecting information. This is kind of a placeholder in case the funding runs out next year. That at least we've got some language in there, so we can do it. And we will have an ability to address this in civil law and on the floor, and if there's any more work we need to do on it.
But yeah, and Mr. Chairman, that's I guess why I was saying that for extreme cases, maybe until we know more about it, I'm not so opposed to it. But in the broad case that right now it stands, and I think we should know more about it before we expose everybody to this.
Okay. All right. If there's no more questions, Representative Woodard, do you want to restate your motion?
I would, and just one quick statement on that, Representative Murray, that that's exactly what we're trying to do here, is kind of bring it into the state family as opposed to being in the federal purview so that we can have those kinds of discussions. So I would like to renew my motion that House File 2470 be passed and referred to the Civil Law Committee.
Okay, you heard the motion.
Sorry, 2435, sorry. Representative
Murray. As amended.
As amended. Okay.
All right. All in favor say aye.
Okay.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Thank you. And the next meeting is tomorrow at 10:15. Thank you for your patience. Another copy of the bill.